Okay, so the assignment zero is supposed to be due today. So just, you know, pass it on to the front and then I'll take it with me. That's the easiest thing to do. Are there questions? Other questions of any other kind? Ooh, this is staple? Yeah, I know. I think teachers should have like staplers implanted in their fingers. Okay. So, are there any questions from last class or anything else? Okay. I am going to actually go back a little and talk about this example because there were some questions on the blog and I think it'll be interesting to discuss a little about how sensing actions work in the world. I sent a mail on this, but you know, if you didn't read it, you know, we can actually discuss this here. So here is a simple scenario. So we have a healthy person who is alive, who accidentally walks into a Springfield nuclear plant and gets irradiated, and so she may or may not have a deadly disease now. Okay. And the disease, if they have disease, they will be, D is true, if not, D is not true. And there's a medication which, if in fact the person has the disease, will cure her off of it, but if she doesn't have the disease, will kill her. Okay? I mean, we have that kinds of medicine, right, in general. If not kill, at least maim, you know, things like that can be done. And there's a test which, if you administer it onto patients who have the disease, will change their tongue to make it bright red. And if they don't have the disease, then their tongue is just the normal sad color. And then you can observe, there's a sensing action, you can observe by looking, at their tongue to see whether or not it's red. Okay? And then these are the actions you have. So you have basically the medicate action, and there is this radiate action which got done, whether you liked it or not. Okay, and then there is the look action, which is a sensing action. Sensing actions are quite interesting, so we'll talk about it a little bit today. Okay, although we won't talk about it for a long, long time to come again during the semester. So in some sense, we are much more ambitious in the last class and this class than we will be for a while, because we will actually get down to classical scenarios where the world is static and it's deterministic, fully observable, etc. Okay, all of these in this particular world, is it fully observable? Of course not. That's why you didn't know whether or not this person has the disease. Okay, so here is the state space graph, partial part of the state space graph. Okay, that we can look at. So first of all, you notice that in the beginning, the person is alive, so the state is completely known, alive. Okay, now when you do radiate, after the radiate action, either the person is alive and has the disease, or the person is alive and doesn't have the disease. Okay, so in the class I told you that non-deterministic actions correspond to hyper edges, right? But they are hyper edges if you think in terms of the normal state space. However, if you think in terms of the belief states, then it's just normal edges. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you are thinking in terms of the state space where alive is one state and alive and disease is another state and alive and not disease is another state, then the action of radiate is really going to either take you here or take you here. That's a non-deterministic action. But if you think in terms of belief states, then what you did was you threw the uncertainty into the state, because the state now is really a set of real world states, right? So I can basically talk about this radiate action, which is actually a non-deterministic action, but it is really just a single edge in the belief space. It's not a hyper edge. Okay? And so after the radiate action, essentially you have the person with the disease or the person without the disease. Both are possible. You don't quite know which one it is right now. Okay. Now, of course, I can go ahead and do Medicate on this person. If I do Medicate on this person, then what happens is that in essence, this, if it was, this is the real state, then I would be getting no disease and alive. And if this is the real state, then no disease and not alive. Yes? No, 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 the medication, this medication has the property that if you don't have the disease,
it kills you. Right?
It kills you.
Yeah, so it would be the other way around. If you have the disease, the disease
if you have the...
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, see, this is not what I want to do. I'm just showing you. Everything is possible in the state space. You pick a part of the state space and you do the plan for that, right?
Okay.
So if you were to do Medicaid, then you would be in this state. Now, is this a goal state? This is not the goal state, because in the goal state, the patient should be cured and be alive. Okay? Here, essentially, the patient is definitely cured, because irrespective of what the state is, the patient is cured. But she is no longer alive. You know, in one case, she's alive, one case, she's dead. So 50% chance. Okay? But that's not good enough. Okay. In fact, if you have probabilities, then you might say, yeah, 90% chance that the person is alive, let's go ahead and do it anyway. And, you know, this is not a laughable matter. In fact, when you are near, when you have a really bad disease, then sometimes they'll do experimental surgeries and they'll make you, and if you are already in a coma, then make your wife or your father or your mother or your children sign, saying, during this operation, this person might croak, and, we can't be held responsible. Even normally, we can't be held responsible, but in this particular case, there's a good chance that they might actually get cured, but there's a small chance that during the operation, they'll go. But if you don't do it, then they're definitely going to go. So are you just increasing the probability that they might be alive? So we do this all the time. So in the non-deterministic case, of course, we have no clue as to what is the probabilities of each of them. And we know that possibly after they definitely they don't have disease, but possibly they're dead. So you don't want to take that. Okay, so what other things can you do? So you can do a test action, this testing action, and all it does essentially is that if in the case where the disease is true, the tongue becomes red. In the case where the disease is not true, the tongue is not red. Okay? So the interesting thing, I'm sorry, what did I do? We have died. What?
Yellow.
Oh, good. That's not good. So what are we going to do on this? We need to get somebody, I guess. I guess maybe it's lamp died or something. Ew. What? Let's see, this is not.
It's not the lamplight, but I can't read which
light. It says primary. Well, we just have to go and ask them, I guess, now. Well, I think the budget cuts have started. So we really don't know what to do. I can turn this around, and you can look at it. I'm not quite sure. Let me try to get these people, and then we'll see what we can do. Yunsang, can you go and tell them? Thank you. Sorry. You know where these guys are, right there, right? It's right in the front, and when you come up the stairs.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Let's see what we can do. Okay. So, let me do the fun thing and then write it down on the board and continue. So you had disease and alive are not disease and alive. That's the belief state you had. Okay? And if you did Medicaid, then you get into the trouble that you definitely not have a disease, but you may actually not be alive. You know, in this case, actually, it would be alive. And in this case, not alive. Now, one of the interesting things in this particular scenario is that you are unable to presumably see whether or not the person has the disease. Right? So that's why the world is not accessible. It's not fully observable. If you know whether or not they have the disease, then you can just do the right action. Okay? Although you don't know, this action knows. When you do the action, it actually knows, because in some sense the action is working on this belief state, this state separately, and generates a new belief state. Okay? The question, of course, is for the agent to know rather than just depend on the action. Okay? And so you can do another action, basically, which is a test action. And the test action will get you disease, alive, and red tongue, and no disease, alive, and not red tongue. Okay? And at this point, you still are not done. All you are able to do is now you converted a part of the state that was invisible to you to be visible to you through the redness of the tongue. So now you have a sensing action which can look at the tongue. If you had a sensing action which can just tell you directly whether disease is there, then you would have been done before itself. You don't need this expensive test. Okay? So then, now the question, of course, is, so I do the look action here. What actually happens when I do the look action? What? Oh, it came back. So what actually happens, we'll see how long it'll go. What actually happens when I do the look action? The interesting thing is that when you figure out that the tongue is red, it doesn't change the world. It only changes your head. Okay? Except in quantum mechanics, observation doesn't change the world. Right? I mean, since we talked a lot about uncertainty principle, that's the only place where when you try to observe, you also change the world. Okay? So here, actually, all you did was, by looking, you know which state you really are in. So effectively, what happens is that the sensing action is a hyper edge in the belief space. Okay? And so after the sensing action, you essentially say, if it is yes, then you will be here. If it is no, then you know you're here. And the sensing action, the interesting thing about sensing action is that it's a runtime thing. So during the time when you're thinking about the world before executing, you don't quite know what would happen when you look after the test. If the person had the disease, then their tongue would be red. If they didn't have the disease, then their tongue won't be red. Okay? So at the runtime, when you actually execute it, then in essence what it's doing is it would split this state, this belief state, into two different belief states. It's not simplifying. All it's doing is it's splitting the uncertainty. It's reducing the uncertainty of the world. Okay? We have talked about many ways of reducing the uncertainty in the world. One of which is bombing. No, another of which is basically putting everything into the toilet. Okay? Those, you reduce the uncertainty, but you also change the world. You can reduce the uncertainty by changing the world. Right? Here, you're reducing the uncertainty without changing the world. Sensing is interesting because it reduces the uncertainty in the state without changing it. Pure sensing, at any rate. That's why sensing is interesting. And we do it all the time. You never thought about what exactly is sensing doing. When you looked at something, you didn't change it. All that changed is your head. Okay? Just a second. And so, now the point is that at this point, you would know which branch you are in at the runtime. And if you are in this branch, then you do medicate. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, if you do it this way, then the patient would be free of disease. Okay, and in essence, this is now, the plan now is to do test and then check if the tongue is red. If yes, medicate. If no, do nothing. And this is called a contingent plan. It's a conditional plan. It's a tree. And the tree ends with the person being free of disease and being alive in all ways. That's why it's a complete plan. Okay? And so the two interesting things that I want you to understand is, one, radiate, even though it's a non-deterministic action, it's actually a single edge in the space of belief states. And the second point is that when you do sensing, you don't change the world whatsoever. You just reduce your uncertainty. So you split the belief state. Okay? Sensing partitions the belief state. Okay? And then, so you do in this case actually have a contingent plan, because you have to pick that whole thing. You need to know what to do for when the sensing says yes or no. Yes, there's a question. What?
All your other edges are an action, and the tongue red edge flips off the middle as a pattern.
Yeah.
I know it doesn't change the world. Is that the only reason it's not in its own protect?
No. See, this is an action. This is an action. This is also an action. It's just an hyper edge. It's a hyper edge. So hyper edges are back again, even in the belief space, if you do sensing. Okay, so from a graph theoretic point of view, non-deterministic actions are still normal edges. They just go from sets to sets. But when you do sensing, the set has to be split, and you have to do different things for different branches. So then it's a hyper edge back again. Okay, so that's, I mean, I was trying to go over it quickly that time, but, you know, since there were questions, I thought may as well go on it, you know, more carefully. Okay, and then in fact there's all sorts of interesting questions you can ask as to, you know, in this particular scenario it's a partially observable world, because through a test action, through this test, you took a part of the world which is not observable and made it observable. And this is actually what you do a lot of times in real world. Okay. So last class we were talking about the 8 puzzle, and then we talked about how we can come up with states, operators, and goal test. Goal test, of course, is whichever is your final configuration. We also talked about the fact that the state space for this guy, for the 8 puzzle problem, is split. It's basically bipartite. And so if your initial state is in one partition and the goal state is in another partition, you're dead. Okay. However, if you know, as long as we'll assume that we'll be considering scenarios where initial and goal state are on the same partition. Okay. And the simplest way to make them in different partitions is take a puzzle and physically swap two styles. And then they would be in a different partition now. Okay. Now there are other examples. So there is 8 puzzle, and here is another problem: robotic path planning, which is actually, you know, will also be, you can keep this also in the back of your head so that you won't say that the entire problem solving agent and search is being developed just for 8 puzzle problem. Any problem which has an initial state and a goal state and operators is fine. Okay? So if I have to go from one place to another place and there are, you know, funny obstacles in the middle, and this is what robots do when they're trying to, you know, navigate hallways with unknown, you know, with known obstacles, right? So the states are the free space regions. You can either think of them in terms of small pixels, or you can think of them as big regions, you know, whichever way you want to write it. Operators are movement from the current region to one of the neighboring regions. Okay? And the goal test is reaching the goal region. Okay? And then the path cast, of course, is the number of movements you make or the total amount of distance you traveled. That's what you want to minimize, for example. So that's another example. So what I want to do now is start talking about search algorithms, where essentially once I know the initial state, the goal test, and the path cast, I can start talking about, can I get a sequence of operators that will take me from the initial state configuration to the goal state one. And the idea then is, once I get that, I can start blindly executing them one after other after other. And if my world really is static and it is deterministic, then I would be sure that when I'm done with all my actions, I would be in the goal state. Okay? So search idea basically, again, it comes from that old architecture figure where now the agent is trying to think, given I know the current state, given I know where I want to be, basically I want to be in a state where goal test will be true, what must I do next? And to do that, it actually comes here and makes itself a path to go from the current state to a goal test satisfying state. And then it goes back and starts executing them one after other. So all of the search that we'll be discussing for now at any rate is going to be offline. That means you look at the world, you figure out what your state is, and then shut off the world. You close your eyes for a while. Think. Come up with a sequence of actions and then start executing. We'll talk about what happens when you start interleaving execution as well as thinking, but for now, let's assume it's offline. Okay. And of course, what is a general search? General search is, suppose you go back to the Romania map. So we talked about three things till now, the Romania map, the free space, are the eight puzzles. All of them are, you know, examples that for which you can model them as this, and there are many, many more. So if I was starting from Arad and I'm trying to go to this place, then I can say, well, here's Arad, and then I can, you know, develop all the neighboring regions that I can get to, neighboring cities I can get to, based on the actions. So in fact, I will call the child generator function, which just says, here are all the new states you can get to. Okay, and then of course, up to this point, everybody knows it's the same thing to do. And if one of these is the goal state, you are happy. Okay, if not, then the question is, which of these are you going to expand next? That's ultimately the search algorithm. Okay, what's the order in which you expand the nodes that come into being? Okay, and so the notion of expansion essentially is, take the state of the problem, give it to a child generator function, which came as part of the problem. So you don't even need to know what's inside the state, because remember, problem-solving agents think of states as black boxes. So all they do is they take the state, there's a procedure called goal test, which when applied says yes or no. And there's another procedure called child generator, which when applied gives a list of new states. And so the question is, which of them are you going to apply the child generator function to, and how do you start? That's all we need to do. Okay, so the strategy in which you pick things from the, you know, basically we'll talk about, in a minute we'll talk about the notion of search queue, which, you know, is not too surprising for most of you, because you have queues in which, you know, the new nodes are put. And the way you organize the search queue winds up changing the way the search algorithm works. Okay, that's what we'll get to in a minute. But before I go there, we'll start differentiating between states and nodes. States are the states of the real world. So in the eight puzzle problem, different states correspond to different puzzle configurations. Okay, in the robot problem, different states correspond to different places where the robot is standing. Okay. But nodes, on the other hand, are data structures that a search algorithm operates on. And it's easiest to think of a node as a data structure with multiple fields. One field corresponds to the state of the world. Another field corresponds to, you know, the parent that generated this node. Parent is also a node that generated this node. Another field corresponds to the list of children, pointers to the list of children that this node generated, if you were to apply the child generator function. And then you can have other things like, you know, depth at which the node is appearing, and the cost, the total amount of operators, the cumulative cost of the operators that led you from the original node, the initial node, to this node. The reason we differentiate it this way is that a search algorithm can potentially come to the same state many, many, many times. In fact, some of them can come to the same state infinitely many times. And every time you come to the same state, it's a new node. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because you have a different parent, you have a different cast, you are pointing to the same state, but you came in a different direction. Okay, so we'll keep that in mind. A search node essentially, you know, multiple nodes can correspond to the same state. Okay, and we'll assume that the child generator function and the goal test function take as their inputs the search nodes and do their thing. Okay, it will basically take the state part of the search node and say whether or not it's a goal, and they'll also take the state part of the search node and expand it to a bunch of children states, and then package them into new nodes and send it back. Okay? So keep that in the back of the mind. And so as far as we are concerned with that in the back, an implementation of the search algorithm is like this. So you start with an empty queue, which corresponds to the initial state. You know, you put the initial state into a node. Okay, that node has no parent because it came into being by itself, and it still doesn't have any children. Its depth is zero. The cost to get to it is zero. So you initialize that. That's the initial node. Put it into the queue. Okay, and then you do this loop until you're done. And all this loop is saying is, if the queue is empty, and you saw that the queue is empty, that means you never found a node which satisfied the goal test. So declare failure and get out. That means there's no solution. Okay. Otherwise, remove from the front of the queue the node. So it's a queue. Okay. The way we manage the queue changes, but you always remove the node from the front of the queue. Okay. So take the front of the node, front of the queue node, and then first thing you do is check whether it satisfies the goal. So you call goal test onto that particular node. If it says yes, you say success and return this node. Okay, and that node has all the information you need to bring back the path, right? Because the node contains pointer to the parent, who then contains pointer to its parent, who then contains pointer to its parent, until the root node, which has no pointers to any parent. So then you just reverse that list and you have the path. Okay. So if the goal test is true, then you succeed. Otherwise, then you basically take this node, expand it to new children, and the way you expand it is by calling the child generator function, which is a problem specific function. Just as the goal test, child generator function, basically the operator's function, comes part of the problem. What is interesting about the search itself is it uses its own specific queuing function. It's not problem specific, but the search algorithm specific. And you can already see, I mean, it probably won't come as a huge surprise to you, that you could do a queuing function could be a normal queue, first in, first out queue, which would correspond to breadth first search. It can be last in, first out queue, which corresponds to depth first search. So breadth first versus depth first. It can be a prioritized queue where each node has a number, okay? And the higher the number, the farther behind it is in the queue. Okay, and then the prioritized queue, again, the numbers, the priorities can be just based on the cost to get to that node, that is the cumulative cost of actions to get to that node, which is already present, by the way, in this G value. You can remember this. The first node's cost to get to itself is zero. Its children, basically, if the first node has a child, one of the children, and that you got there by action A1, and you know the cost for the action A1, so you add that to the parent, you get the child's cost. So this is very easy to do. Okay? So now I can actually do priority function in terms of the G value. And that winds up being very similar to breadth first, except it's called uniform cost search. Basically, it's a breadth first search which, instead of going level by level, it goes cost by cost. So first the cheaper cost nodes are expanded, and then the higher cost nodes are expanded. Okay, but this cost is the cost to get to this node. What you really want is cost of the best path through this node to the goal state. Okay? And since you don't know the future, you know, basically you need to have estimates as to how far is the current node to a goal state. to do that, you would need a heuristic function. We'll get to that again in a minute, okay? Actually, probably several minutes later. But I'm just telling you that by changing the queuing function, you get pretty much all the different search algorithms, okay? So if you have, for a node, apart from this G value, if I also give a H function, which is a heuristic function, which gives a number, and that is somehow an estimate of how far is the nearest goal node from this node, then I can prioritize the nodes, not in terms just of G values, but G plus H values. And if you do that, you get A star search. Okay, we'll talk about it again and again, but you know, that's where you are. Okay? Yes?
Did you get stuck going through the same path? Like,
that's the question. So we will see, for example, which kinds of queuing functions can get you into trouble and which kinds of queuing functions won't. So we'll talk in a minute as to what would be the properties of search algorithms that you would be interested in talking about. Okay? So search algorithms differ based on the specific queuing function they use. All search algorithms must do goal test only when the node is picked up for expansion. This you should remember, because all our proofs depend upon the fact that when you pick the node up for expansion, then you check whether it's a goal node or not. Okay? It's not just it's there somewhere on the queue. Wow, I can see a goal node on the queue, I stop. If you do that, you can actually get into trouble. You won't necessarily get some properties correct. Okay? So let's remember this, that all search algorithms must do goal tests only when the node is picked up for expansion. And then we have to talk about properties of the search algorithms, and in general we tend to do them on these uniform trees. Okay? But let me do that more in this slide. So what kinds of properties are you interested in for search strategies? Okay, here are some. Completeness. You would say a search algorithm is complete if the original problem has a solution, then the search algorithm will find a solution. That's what completeness means. If the original problem did have a solution, you can't say you still find one. That makes no sense. Okay. Now, completeness is a proof. You have to provide the proof beforehand, because when I give you a complex enough problem, all you know is what your search algorithm does. If it comes and says, I didn't find a solution, do you know for sure that that's because there is no solution, or that's because your search algorithm is lazy? So before you let it loose onto the problem, you should have proved to yourself whether or not the algorithm would be complete. Completeness, by the way, is a global property. So any global property you have to prove to yourself beforehand. Local property, you can look at it and say, yeah, that looks good.
But right now we're discussing offline.
Yes.
Right. So completeness, that for example, let's say we're doing a coloring problem and on a bipartite problem, mm-hmm. something like that. We'll beforehand know if it is complete or not, right?
What do you mean? I'm talking about whether the search algorithm.
Some search algorithm can work on a specific type of graph.
Mm-hmm.
There's a special type of graph. If you have a special type of graph, maybe that algorithm will work. But in case it's an offline algorithm,
mm-hmm.
you know for sure what kind of graph it is. So
not necessarily. Keep that question in your mind. Okay? So completeness is if you need to be able to provide a proof that if there is a solution, the search algorithm will find it. Okay? Then optimality, which is if the search algorithm gives you a solution, it is the lowest cost such solution possible. And these are two different things, because completeness, a search algorithm might give you a solution, but it's not necessarily optimal. The other one, an optimal means if it does give you a solution, it's optimal. But sometimes it doesn't give you a solution, even when there is one. So you need both properties. Once again, optimality is a global property, so you need to prove it beforehand. Because if I give you something and say, this is the optimal solution, how are you going to check? The only way you check is to look at all other possible solutions and see that this is the lowest cost one. If you have to do that, then why have me around? Right? If you, there's no point in having a secretary if you're going to see his or her work every 3 seconds to see whether or not they're doing it right. You have to have a proof in your mind that they'll do the right thing. Otherwise, you're doing more than the work that you were doing before. Okay? So the optimality. Time and space complexity. Time complexity is how much time does the search algorithm take to find the solution. Okay? Now, obviously, it depends on how long the solution is. Right? You don't expect a search algorithm to find a solution which is 10,000 steps long in time that's less than 10,000 steps. I mean, that's proportional to a quantity that's less than 10,000. Okay? So at the minimum, it's connected somehow to the length of the solution. The question is it connected to the solution in a linear way, which is the best thing you can hope for? That means, you know, if the solution is length L, then your search algorithm will find it in order length L time, order L time. Or is it L square, L cube, or the computer scientist's nightmare, something power L. Okay, 2 power L is 1, but B power L. B is the branching factor power L. Okay. And we'll find that most blind search algorithms will essentially have a time complexity of B power L, where branching factor power the length of the solution, which is exponential. Now, the other interesting question is space complexity. How much space does the search algorithm take? Now, one of the interesting things that you have to keep in mind about space complexity, and that's really the only thing that you need to know, is that space complexity is the maximum space that your algorithm will ever need, even for a nanosecond. It's not the average space that something needs. Okay? If your program needs 1 byte more than the total amount of RAM you have, and you don't have secondary memory, and it only needs it like every once in a blue moon, your program is still going to die on that day, right? So when you talk about space complexity, you don't talk about average space, you talk about the maximum space that would be required. That too can be proportional to the size of the solution, which is on one extreme, or proportional to L square or L cube, which would be sort of polynomial in the length of the solution, or happily proportional to something power L, which would be exponential in the size of the solution. Interestingly, you'll find that most of the search algorithms that you already know and love, in fact, the one of the search algorithms that you know and love has exponential complexity. The other one actually has linear space complexity. Whereas both of them are just as bad in terms of time complexity. They're both B power D. Okay. Now, when I'm saying B and D, I have a model of the search tree in my mind, search graph in my mind. Okay, and we'll basically do to make our lives easy. We will try to do, we'll tend to do the analysis on uniform search trees. A uniform search tree basically is a tree, and it has the same branching, you know, same number of children for every node. Okay, so this is a uniform search tree of branching factor, actually 4. I don't know why I wrote 3. Yeah, I was asleep. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, branching factor 4. And the depth in this particular case, depth 0, depth 1, depth 2, depth 3. Right? 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. 3 and 4. So you start with depth 0. Okay, so given in this particular case, you can start talking about, you know, how much time would the search tree and search algorithm take. Okay. So here, first we'll start talking about uninformed search strategies. Uninformed search strategies are those which don't have the heuristic that I talked about. That means it basically only consider how far I have I come, not how far do I still have to go. Do you understand what I'm saying? And oftentimes, to figure out how far you have to go, you need to solve the problem. I mean, if you are a kid, I mean, if you have kids in particular, you know, the kids sitting in the back seat of the car always keep asking, how far, how far, how far do we have to go? And then until you get there, you don't quite know how far you have to go, how long you still have to drive. Okay? So we make up some number and say, oh, just 2 more minutes. And then they'll wait for another half a minute and ask you again. Okay, but the point is, uninformed essentially means you don't have any information about the future, not even an estimate. Okay, and the question then is, you know, what are the search algorithms that work with no more, you know? So the informedness comes from the heuristics normally. Okay, we'll talk about that next class. So, but let's talk about the uninformed search strategies. And there is breadth first, there is depth first. Both this one basically is a FIFO queue. In the queuing function, it's FIFO, first in, first out. Depth first is LIFO, last in, first out. Uniform cost search is a priority queue, which puts the nodes prioritized in the value of G, G being the total cost of the actions that you took from the root node to get to this node. Okay? And then we also talk about two other things you may or may not have heard of. So by the way, you know these three. I think depending on who taught you 3.10, you should know these three. Okay, you may have heard of this as Dijkstra's algorithm in different variations. Okay, and you know breadth first and depth first. And what you may or may not have heard of is depth limited and iterative deepening search. Okay, and they have some interesting properties, and we'll talk about those two. Okay, so breadth first, in the case of breadth first, the queuing function is put the successors always at the end of the queue. And you're bringing things out from the front, and you put the successor at the end of the queue. Now, there is one minor issue, which is suppose the queue contains node 1, et cetera, up to node 7, and then you just took node 1, N1, and you expanded it into node 8, node 9, node 10. Which order do you put them into the queue? It doesn't matter. As long as they all come after N7, it doesn't matter which permutation you use. Do you understand what I'm saying? So all children are equal. Okay? So that's basically breadth first. You know, clearly, it's not all that hard to figure out how breadth first works. Right? So you start with the first node, you generate all its children, then, you know, by convention, you take the leftmost node, and then expand that, then the next expand, then the next expand. Before expanding any node, you ask, is it a solution? That's what you do. Okay? Now, if you think of what the breadth first search, so for example, on this particular thing, so this node comes into being first, then when you expanded it, you get this. Then you expand this, then you expand this, then you expand this, then you expand this, so you have up to that tree. Then you start expanding this, and so on. Okay? Now, if you think in terms of graph, so basically when you have a graph, underlying search space, state space is actually a graph, then in essence what you're doing is that you are looking at the graph via contours. Okay? Breadth first search looks at the graph in terms of contours, where the contours are defined in terms of just the number of operators, not the cost, not the distance, but just the number of operators. Okay? So in the first iteration, you'll only look at the start node. Second iteration, you look at all nodes which are one step away. Third iteration, you look at all nodes which are two steps away. Fourth iteration, you look at all nodes which are, right? Now, the interesting thing, of course, is if you have this view, then you can start asking questions about the properties of the breadth first search. Is it complete? Yes. If there is a solution, now remember that when I say there is a solution, that means it should be at a finite depth. Even if it's an infinite-sized graph, to say that there is a solution, we assume that the solution is at a finite depth. Otherwise, it's not a solution. No, you can't execute an infinitely long sequence. Okay, so if it is at a finite depth, then you know that you will always find it while you go by these contours. If it is in depth k, then at the kth iteration, you will find it. And before you expand it, you'll check whether it's a goal node or not, and the goal node will say yes, and you're done. So it's complete. Okay? Now, of course, the only question, of course, is whether even if the depth is finite, if the branching factor is infinite, then you are still dead. So we have to, you know, make the argument that the branching factor is finite. Okay. Again, I am sitting here assuming that the graphs that I will be handling would be infinitely large, as I told you last class. That's the difference between 310 and here. Okay. But most graphs would not have infinite branching factor. They could very well have infinite depth. But the solution, if there is one, would be at a finite depth. Okay. How about time? The time essentially is, again, I don't know whether I mentioned it previously or not, I should say it again, that normally the state, the time complexity and the space complexity are measured in a sort of a stylized way. Okay, you can talk about clock time, of course. You can also talk about, you know, number of bytes taken. But another stylized way we tend to do it is time complexity is measured in terms of the number of nodes expanded. That means the number of times you call the child generator function. Because the assumption is that is the part where you do the maximum amount of work in each iteration after search node, after search loop. Okay? So time complexity is normally measured in terms of the number of nodes expanded. Not generated, but expanded. Okay? Generated means that they are in the queue somewhere. Expanded means they got out of the queue, you looked at them, whether they are goal or not. And if they're not goal, you actually call the child generator function. Okay. And then space complexity is measured just in terms of the number of nodes in the queue. And so whatever is the largest size the queue ever got to, that's the space complexity. Okay. It's complete. And time-wise, basically, you know, if you have to find a search node at depth D, if your goal is at depth D, then you have to expand every node in the tree until the depth D. So first level 1, second level there are B such nodes, third level there are B square such nodes, all the way up to the Dth level where there are B power D such nodes. Again, assuming uniform tree model. Okay? Which would be B power D plus 1 minus 1 by B minus 1. Which is your geometric series summation, which we can think of it as order b power b. Okay, so exponential time. Okay, space. What happens to space? Space basically, it turns out that the worst case happens, happens when in the last level, your goal is the very last node. And so you essentially had to keep this entire last level in the memory and then slowly remove one by one. Okay? And so the maximum you will ever grow to is B power D, which is again exponential.
This is just assuming the static world.
What?
I mean, this is a very conservative estimate. Even if it's not,
this whole thing is offline. We are talking about, you know, the graph search. Okay? So, now is it optimal? Again, it's optimal because if you have, it's optimal as long as you think that each operator has cost 1. Each operator has the same cost. If all operators have the same cost, okay, then the depth at which the goal node appears is also its cost, or is actually proportional to its cost. So when talking about optimality, then you are worried maybe you will end up with a node which is at k plus 1th level when there is actually a node at kth level, which is a goal node. But that cannot happen because you go level by level. Okay, you can do a more formal proof, but it's pretty obvious that you essentially are going level by level, and you cannot miss. If you went to k plus 1th level, it's because there is not a single goal at the kth level, up to kth level. So the first one you find would be optimal. You understand? Okay. Again, this is a proof. So when the search algorithm gives you a solution, that's not when you are checking whether it's optimal or not, because checking optimality is impossible. You have to look at all the other solutions. But because of the way the algorithm works, you are guaranteed that when it stops, it will be optimal. And once you prove it to yourself once, then you just forget about it and you are happy. It's certified ISO brand optimal. Okay. Now the problem about this, it turns out, is space is a problem, time is a problem. Okay, of course, we would like to be done much faster. But space is also a problem. And space is something that, in fact, we can reduce. We'll see, I mean, those of you who thought about it before, you know already that depth-first search actually has a much better performance in terms of space. We'll see it in a minute. Okay? But really what happens is that if you go with breadth-first, the space is the biggest problem. Okay, because time-wise, you're sunk anyway. Nobody else does much better than you. Okay, space-wise, there are other uninformed search strategies which do better than you. Okay, so here are some numbers. For example, this is already old stuff, but in terms of old CPUs, but if you have depth 14 and essentially you have a branching factor 10, and you can expand 1,000 nodes per second, and you probably require 100 bytes per node, let's say, then the back of the envelope estimate says that for a depth of, for a solution which is 14 long, that means 14 operators long, you would take 3,500 years, which is okay, but you also would need 11,000 terabytes. Okay? Now, you can say that, well, my CPUs are much faster. Put in your CPU numbers and see, you know, how many years you want to wait. Maybe it won't be 3,500 years, maybe it's just 100 years, okay, for 14 size, okay. But the point is, time-wise you're dead, space-wise also you're dead, okay. Now we'll look at the next one, which is depth-first search. And depth-first search is LIFO. That means it will expand things, and the latest coming node. So for example, in this example, when n, you know, if you picked n1 and you got n8, n9, and n10, they all come in the front, not in the back, in any which order, but they have to come in the front. Okay, the classic case of depth first is primogeniture, right? So the way royalty goes, you know, if I think this Prince Charles will be always first in the throne, and if he never becomes the king of Britain, then his first child will be first in the throne, and if they don't become the king of England, then a king or queen of England, then their first child will become the first dibs. And Prince Charles' brother is gone case, so is Prince Charles' younger son is gone case. They'll never ever get to be, you know, they may as well come off to some other country, right? So anyway, but that's depth first. Basically, primogeniture is a classic example of depth first. Okay, so what happens, let's see, so again, if you go back to your, this picture here, you would start here, okay? The first level, you get all these four nodes in. And the second level, you expand this node, you get these four nodes in, but now they will be in front of these three nodes in the queue. So in the third level, you expand this. And in the fourth level, you expand this, and so on. Until one particular branch dies out, in which case you come back and expand the immediate sibling. And this all just happens automatically because of the way the queue is being managed. Right? So what's the interesting thing about depth-first search? Complete? Yes, sir.
In breadth-first search, we said that all children are equal. Note the order at which the children are added to the queue doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. In neither of them does it matter. You assume that all children are equal. Okay. And when you start taking costs into account, then you will say all nodes with the equal cost are equal. You don't differentiate between them. Okay. So, completeness. Is depth-first search complete? Depth first search is complete. Now you do this. And I say, is it complete? And you say, yes, yes, yes. And then you can all yell at me at the end of the semester saying, you wasted our time by reteaching what we are supposed to have known in 310. And you're supposed to have known in 310 that depth first search is incomplete. Why is it incomplete? Because it can go into cycles. Okay? There are multiple ways depth first search can become incomplete. One is, if you have infinitely long tree, directed tree, okay, so this branch will go to La La Land, but there is a nice solution at the second level on this branch. You'll never find it because you're going to La La Land right away, right? That's one way. Even if, in fact, the search tree is not infinitely deep anywhere. If there are cycles in the search tree, so you can go there, come back here, go there again, come back here again. In effect, the search tree will be infinitely deep if you don't take into account the cycle. Now, interestingly, breadth first search, even in the presence of cycles, will still do the right thing because it goes level by level by level. Right? Whereas depth first search can go into cycles and it can go into the la la land. So it's not complete.
But the check for cycles is pretty easy to do in depth first search.
We'll get there in a second. Okay, it's not all that easy. But you know, it turns out that we will talk about that in a minute. Okay? So it's not complete. Time wise, what about the time? It turns out it's actually an interesting analysis. I'll let you look at it, but it's still exponential. Even if it is uniform tree, okay, it's still exponential. And you will say, how can this be? Because if the goal is here, I would have found it right away. Yes? The best case scenario for depth first search, time wise, is just D expansion. But then the worst case scenario, the goal is here. It will take B power D expansion. So the question is, what's the average? The average is, well, it can be, in fact, the goal can be here or here or here or here or here, any of these places. Yet the depth D. Now what's interesting is that this plus this will add up to the same number as this plus this in terms of the number of nodes expanded. This is like that joke, that anecdote that people talk about, Frederick Gauss. You know, how many people know Gauss? Okay. Yes. So you should know. I mean, otherwise you'll be out. Gauss is one of the greatest mathematicians, and he also is known for something that isn't particularly, you know, it didn't take a huge amount of smartness for him, but we know Gauss because of Gaussian distribution mostly. That's the least of the interesting things he did. Okay, I mean, he's an amazing, amazing mathematician. And apparently when he was 4 years old, you know, he was in gymnasium, you know, in Germany, and, you know, so he was doing too much noise, and then so the teacher said, you know, to keep him quiet, they said, you know, add up numbers 1 to 100 and come back to me. Maybe not 4, maybe 4.5. Okay. So 1 to 100 and come back to me, so he'll keep him quiet for a while. And he right away came and said, yeah, it's 50-50. Okay. How did he do it? Because in essence, he said 1 plus 100 is 101, 2 plus 99 is 101, 3 plus 98 is 101, and you essentially have 50 of those combinations. So multiply that. Okay, and that's essentially what you can do in this particular case too, because irrespective of where the goal is here, for every goal that can fall here, there is another the place it can fall here, such that the sum would be the same. So the average essentially really is b power d, 1 plus b power, I mean d plus b power d by 2, approximately. So essentially, even depth first search is dead in terms of time. Okay? We are talking about worst case time analysis. As I said, the best case is just D. Okay, in the best case it's D. On the other hand, breadth first search best case is not that different from its worst case. So if you are a congenital lottery player who thinks they are special and they will always win the lottery, you should do depth first because once in a while you might luck out. Okay, but sometimes you can also go la la land because depth first search doesn't stop. Space, that's the greatest thing about depth first search. Space is only linear. Even when it is going to the la la land, it never increases its Q to be more than branching factor times depth at which it currently is. Why? Because in essence, the best way to think about this really is that you start from here and then there are B nodes. And you take this, there are B minus 1 nodes waiting on the queue. And then you expand this. And you take this and you keep B minus 1 nodes waiting on the queue. And so on and so forth, etc. So the worst case would be there are D levels at each level B minus 1 nodes are waiting on the queue. That's ever the largest size for the queue. So D times B minus 1 R, which is order BD, linear space. Okay? So you have linear space. Is it optimal? Are you kidding? No. It's not optimal, because even if there is a goal node here, it will find the goal node in this branch first. So it's never going to be optimal. Okay? So of the two very well-known algorithms, they already differ in terms of optimality, completeness, and space complexity. They are same only in terms of time complexity, average case time complexity, and the worst case time complexity. Okay? Now the question, of course, is this guy does have something we like, linear space, and missing two things we would like to have, which is completeness and optimality. Can we get somehow completeness and optimality while keeping linear space? First, completeness. Okay, let's just talk about completeness first. Okay, here is the idea. The reason, you know, if you don't have cycles, I mean, even if you do have cycles, the reason depth first search will become incomplete is because there exists a branch that is infinitely deep. Right? Either because of cycles or because, in fact, you can do infinitely many different actions. But suppose your rich uncle told you that if there is ever any solution, it won't be more than 200 steps long. If there is a solution at all, it will never be more than 200 steps long. I told you this. Can you use this? Of course you can. Why? Essentially, you say, don't ever expand a node which is more than depth 200. So if a node is at depth 200, you don't call child generator function. Instead, you just, you know, kill that node. In essence, you would call but ignore what the child generator says and say nil is returned, a null list is returned, which means that node dies without having any children. So what I did was I put a limit for the depth first search. I put a limit. And I could put that limit because my rich uncle told me that there are not going to be any solutions more than 200. And you can be conservative. Maybe most solutions are really 10 or 15 steps long, but I still, you know, to be conservative, I said, I'll go all the way up to 200, but I won't go more than that. So if you do that, if in fact that point is true, then depth first search is complete now. Right? Because on a finite tree, depth first search has to end. It's only on infinite trees it won't end. Okay? Right? Is it optimal?
Yeah, pretty much.
No. No. Because there may well be So I put a 200 limit here. So I know that I will never go below this. But there could still be a nice little goal node here at depth 10, and there is a goal node at depth 3, and I will find this first before finding that. Right? Okay, so it's not optimal. Okay, so I got the idea of depth limited search, which essentially gave me completeness but still didn't give me optimality. What can I do to get optimality? Well, let me be my own rich uncle, doubting uncle, and say, well, let me assume that there can't be any goal nodes below depth 1. So let's assume that D equal to 1 first and do a depth limited search. If in fact there is a solution up to depth limit 1, you would find it. If not, you would fail. Then you will say, I'll increase D by D plus 1. I'll do one more depth limited search for D equal to 2. If there is a solution, I'll find it. If not, increase it by D plus 3. This is what's called iterative deepening depth first search. So I'm actually saying depth 1, depth 2, depth 3, and for each depth I'm doing a separate depth limited search. Okay? So if I have a tree like that, then first I will assume depth limit 1, and so I basically have a tree of size 1 because it has just one node. And then I will, you know, do a depth limited depth first search on that tree. The same program, okay? And then if it says here's the goal node, so you are like one of the luckiest people on the earth where the initial node also happens to be the goal node, you say, yeah, I got it. If not, don't give up. Increase D to D plus 1. So now you have a tree of depth, you know, 0 and depth 1. So this much is the tree. Now you do depth limited depth first search. So you go here first, then you go here. If any of them are the goal nodes, you would stop. If not, you would fail. Then you go to the third level. Okay. The interesting thing, of course, is that, is this optimal? Is this optimal? Yes. By design, it's optimal. You know, because you would never have found a goal node at level 12 unless you have completely convinced yourself that there is no goal node at level 11. By definition, it's going to be optimal. Okay? Is it complete? Yes, for the same reason. Is it space efficient? Yes, because ultimately the search that's being done at each iteration is a depth first search. Depth first search turns out to be the only well-known search algorithm that has linear space requirement. So in fact, if you forget ever, we'll look at other variations of iterative deepening search algorithms, but irrespective, in fact, there'll be one called iterative deepening A-star search. Okay? And you might think, wow, since you're doing A-star search, in each iteration you will do A-star search. No. Even iterative deepening A-star search, the reason you would do it is you want the linear space, and so every search, each iteration would still be depth first search. It would still be depth first search. And the only difference between iterative deepening A-star search and iterative deepening search is the way you define the trees at the different levels. Here you define the subtrees completely in terms of levels. In the IDA star, we'll sort of define it in terms of cost contours. When we get there, we'll see that. Okay? So, everything is nice and dandy. So, what's the problem with this idea? If at all there is any problem? Time. You are repeatedly expanding some nodes. You are expanding some nodes repeatedly, right? Because this guy gets expanded how many times? If the search node is at depth D, how many times does this guy get expanded? D times. The level 1 nodes can expand, get expanded D minus 1 times. Level 2 nodes get expanded D minus 2 times and so on. How bad is this going to be? It turns out that if you use your simple elementary calculations on the geometric series summation, so the time for iterative deepening search is D plus 1 times B0. In fact, D, remember, D starts from 0 onwards. So the first node gets expanded once for 0th level, once for 1th level, and so on. So it's really D plus 1 times it gets expanded. So D plus 1 times B power 0 times D times B power 1, which are the nodes at the depth 1, and D minus 1 times B squared, etc., up to the last level nodes will only get expanded once. Okay? So if you sum this, one of the interesting things is it's only B power D. It's still order B power D. Okay? You might, you know, it's sort of like saying, you know, apart from whatever we are doing, suppose we were to, you know, US government still, you know, tries to buy out a small country, would our deficit increase significantly? No, we are already sunk. We have 2 trillion or 3 trillion per second right now. So one more little country bought doesn't change anything. Okay? Because the number of nodes you are expanding originally in the normal depth first search itself is high enough that these extra repetitions didn't make as much of a difference. And another interesting thing about uniform trees is there are half as many nodes in just the last level as the total number of nodes In fact, that's true for binary trees. And there are actually, you know, D times as many here as the rest of the nodes combined. So it's bottom-heavy trees. You know, uniform trees are all bottom-heavy. And the last level, you're not expanding more than once. Okay? So in fact, you can do this, and I will make you do this in the homework. And you can see that in the worst case, for large B and D, the ratio of the number of nodes expanded by iterative deepening depth first search versus normal depth first search is B plus 1 by B minus 1. Now, of course, that quantity is not well defined for B equal to 1, right? So one homework question asks you to think of what happens when B equal to 1. By the way, how does the tree look like when B equal to 1? It's a line. And that's the worst case for iterative deepening depth first search. It's not a search tree, it's a search line. Right? So it actually winds up expanding all the D minus 1 nodes multiple times, except the last node. And, you know, and this formula makes you think that it does infinitely more work, and all I can tell you is it's not as bad. It's a large number, but, you know, still not infinity. And you would do this. It's not that hard. Okay? But the interesting point is, again, you're trying to bring your intuitions about small graphs to large graphs, small trees to large trees. In a small tree, this may actually make a difference, but in a large enough tree, it doesn't make any difference. And what you're getting as the benefit outweighs the little extra expansions you're going to do. In fact, I'll show you, you know, in the last thing that I will show you today, is that, in fact, iterative deepening depth first search can sometimes, surprisingly, do fewer expansions than depth first search. And this should not be surprising to you either. Because if you have infinitely deep branch on one side, depth first search goes to la la land, expanding every darn node on that infinitely deep branch. Whereas iterative deepening depth first search does less. Right? Okay? Okay, so that's this graph, and you know, I don't know whether I should go through this, but you know, you should be able to go home and check that for this graph, BFS, but breadth first search, expands A first, then B, and then expands G. So basically, previously, I didn't show you any examples. I was thinking in terms of trees, but now I'm actually looking at a graph shape, a directed graph in this particular case. Okay, so I'll expand A, I'll get B and G in, and then I'll expand B, I will get C, and then I'll expand G, I'll stop. When I expand, before expanding, I check if it's a goal node or not. G is goal node. Breadth first search does that. Depth first search does A, B, C, D, G. Expansion and stops. Iterative deepening depth first search does A first, then A first, and then A, B, G. And then stops with G. Okay? And this, you can look at this to see actual nodes that are being generated step by step. Because for each state, you put it into your node. Right? And so, in fact, sometimes the same state might come back as part of another node. That's fine. And you can look at this to make sure that you understand that. I want cycles. I don't want directed graphs. Here is a graph which is basically undirected. That means I can go from A to B, and there's also an operator from going from B to A. What happens on the undirected graph? Breadth first search does exactly the same thing as before, in this case, ABG. Depth first search, AB, 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 doesn't stop at all. Right? And iterative deepening depth first search does A, B, G. This is exactly what I was telling you earlier. That here, in fact, iterative deepening depth first search does fewer expansions than depth first search because that thing goes to la la land. Now, this basically tells you that there are cycles. Can't we stop the cycles? Okay? That's the last thing we'll talk about, and we'll probably repeat it again next week. It turns out that stopping cycles looks like an easy thing to do. Okay, so all you need to do is before expanding a node, check to see if you have seen it before. Which means you have to remember everything that you have seen before. Which means even though the queue is lean, mean, and healthy, somewhere else squirreled away on the CPU is a huge list of all the states you have ever seen. So that thing is dying already, even though you have a linear space here. Do you understand what I'm saying? If the search space is exponentially large, right, and if you have to remember everything that you have seen ever to ensure there is no repetition at all, then the space of all the nodes that you have seen should be stored somewhere. That would take a large space. In fact, it would take the exponential space. Furthermore, one can say, well, A, I have seen A, because A equal to A. In general, normal search algorithms, a state can have an arbitrary structure. Suppose a state is a graph, and you got another graph. Can you compare these two graphs to see whether or not they are isomorphic? Graph isomorphism is a costly problem. So you might say, I can cut down the cycle, but you will pay through your nose to cut down the cycle. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So, however, if you say, well, I won't cut down every possible cycle, I will cut down some of the cycles. The two ideas that you can do very well. One is, never allow yourself to come back into the queue. So if I take A, expand, I'll get A back, don't let it come in. Because, you know, I don't have to remember all other nodes I've generated, but I know who I am. And I extend that and say, I know who I am and I know who my father or mother is, so I will never let myself or my parents come back into the queue. And a more general idea is, I just remember my ancestors. And there are only D number of ancestors if I am in depth D. If I just remember my D ancestors, and every child that comes in, every child of mine, if it looks like one of my ancestors, I do the unimaginable thing and kill it. Okay? Right? Just to stop cycles. I don't want to see my ancestors back again in any shape or form. It still doesn't stop all cycles. It only stops my ancestors from coming in. But it may, your ancestors might sneak into my branch, and my ancestors might sneak into your branch. And to stop that, you have to do the extreme thing, which is remember every possible node you ever, every possible state you ever generated, and actually compare them. So both space cost and time cost. Okay? On graph search, the idea that does work well is this, which doesn't completely remove cycles, but in practice, remembering just your ancestors and comparing them to your children, assuming the comparison cost is not too high, does work. And that reduces the number of expansions significantly. We'll stop here. Next time, we'll come back and talk about prioritized queues and A-star search.